Are you frustrated watching your hard-earned money ride the knee-jerking Wall Street roller coaster? Are you looking to diversify into alternate investments and set them on autopilot to achieve financial freedom? It's time to learn the ways of the wealthy. It's time to think outside the stocks with your host, Madhvi Jain, an immigrant from India and ex-IT professional who will bring you industry experts to illustrate a passive and holistic financial approach to build not just passive income, but also your generational wealth. Madhvi is on a mission to change the financial trajectory of one family at a time and 1,000 more to go. Are you going to be part of this vision? And now, without further ado, here is the host of Think Outside the Stocks, Madhvi Jain.
I'm your host, Madhvi Jain, and now we will continue our discussion with the mad scientist of multifamily. So, Neil, we were continuing our discussion and we talked about actually how recession is helpful for the real estate investors. Let's talk about the SVB failure. What is your opinion about the SVB failure and how does it impact the real estate industry, especially the commercial real estate and multifamily? The media is really freaking out the investors. There is so much narrative against the real estate industry. What do you think about this?
Sure, be freaked out. You know, I mean, the media's job is to freak you out. They're doing that really, really well. I'm just sitting and watching to see what's happening. And with what happened with the bank failures, why would that be bad news for multifamily? I think that the multifamily family industry caught a break when Silicon Valley Bank failed. Why? Because we were looking at interest rates or the Fed funds rate, which is right now at 5%, going up all the way to 6.25. That's a lot. That would have hurt us a lot. Right?
Yeah.
Because our interest rates would have increased. So there would have been potentially some contagion, some distress in the multifamily industry. But today, because of the failure of SVB, the Fed is clearly backing off and saying, you know, we might raise interest rates a little bit, but we're not going to raise them like crazy. We see what happens when we raise interest rates like crazy. So they might go up. Well, I'm thinking in May, they go up another quarter point and then they sort of hold, but they don't hold for as long. They start to drop a little bit earlier than they planned. So there's benefits there because that helps the multifamily industry to stabilize. So once again, that's one of those things where it's good and bad. If you're buying now, your window of opportunity is going to shrink because if rates start to drop, then prices will go back up. So that's bad. But if you're buying, you know, you're not overly worried about there being some future contagion or crash in multifamily prices because it clearly looks like we're either at a plateau or close to a plateau for interest rates.
Right. I love that perspective, Neil. And I'm just mind blown how you have kind of put that SVB scenario in terms of multifamily. Never had thought about it that actually for Feds, it's kind of a red flag that, okay, they need to slow down a little bit. And I always say that perspective is everything. So thank you so much for bringing that completely different perspective. And going back to what you said, right, it's really important to understand. I think the cycles that you have explained in different cycles, you can have different strategies and make money in different ways. It's just you should know where to look for these opportunities, right? So I think that's really important. So thanks for highlighting that. Having said that, let's talk a little bit about multifamily. I mean, people often ask me that is multifamily still a good asset class investing in it, right? And, you know, I believe in the fundamentals of multifamily really strongly, essentially from the supply and demand perspective. Give us your perspective on it. That do you think that multifamily is a still, you know, good investment
For a 5-year time frame? Yes. Is it a good investment for a 18-month speculative sort of investment of the sort that people did in 2021 or 2022? No. I think that speculation phase has ended. So if you're the sort of investor that believes that 5 years is a good time frame, then it makes a lot of sense, because here's what our data shows us, right? We know there's a recession coming. Well, recessions are not particularly good for rent growth. You might have, you know, 1% rent growth in a 6% inflation environment. That's not good. You might have 0% rent growth. You might have -1%, -2% rent growth for the next 6 to 9 months. So for the 6 to 9 month perspective, it's probably not good for multifamily. Now, once we end that recession, let's say next year, we should also get some tailwinds because the as a recession starts to end, the Fed starts to cut interest rates. Remember, they put us into this recession. They're forcing a recession. The U.S. economy is not going into a recession. It doesn't want to go into recession. It's fighting the Fed. The Fed's putting us into a recession because they need to cool inflation down, right? So the goal is to use the recession as a tool to cool down inflation. So at the end of the, by the end of that recession, you've achieved that goal. Now you can start lowering interest rates. So as the rates get cut, every time the rates get cut, that's a tailwind for multifamily prices. So you slowly start to see them stabilize, you slowly start to see them increase.
Right.
But just as that happens, we have this issue. We have a very large amount of supply, 700,000 units of Class A product coming into the marketplace. And they come into the marketplace in the second half of this year and the first half of next year. Mm-hmm. And so as they do, they're going to depress rents for a short amount of time. I would say
right.
They're probably going to depress rents in the first half of next year, maybe even until the second half of next year. Now, 2025 is when we really start to benefit. Because what's happening is, right now in 2023, construction activity in the U.S. for single-family homes and multifamily has declined dramatically. So, mm-hmm. New construction activity for apartments probably down 30%, and that 30 percentile is increasing. I think it'll go up to 50. Single families already been more than 30% down for the last 6 months because they felt the pinch very early. And so what we're doing is we're creating a hole in supply. The United States is a growing country. Our population is slowing, but we are a growing country, and we need a certain number of multifamily units and a certain number of single family units every year. And we're currently constructing the right number of single family, right number of multifamily. So we're keeping, in growth with our needs. There's a hole that we had created in the 2008 recession that we haven't filled up. So there's still that
right.
supply gap, the supply demand gap. But we are certainly not making it worse until this year. So in 2023, it's very clear that we're not building a lot of new construction, multifamily, new construction, single family. Now, you might say, is that going to benefit us this year? No, because it takes a while to build them. Will it benefit us next year? No, because there's still new supply coming in. But by 2025, we should start to see this lack of new construction in 2023, this year, start to affect supply in 2025. So now you're in an environment where you have low interest rates and you have insufficient new supply coming in, and we should start to see some pretty significant rent growth. I wouldn't be surprised if 6, 7, 8% rent growth occurs in 2025. Something like that could occur in 2026. Hard to tell. But I think from a timing perspective, those are good times for us to increase rents. Those are good times for us to sell our properties. Maybe we get lucky and we sell them in 2025 and 2026. Maybe we wait until 2027 so we can get the benefit of 2 years of rent growth and sell our properties. So it's key to understand this. If we create a supply hole, and the U.S. basically needs about 800,000 new construction single-family homes, about 400,000 new construction multifamily. That's 1.2 million units. Right now, it seems like we're going to have a 500,000 unit shortage. That 500,000 unit shortage in 2005 can easily drive rents up 6 or 7%. And while 6 or 7 doesn't seem like a sexy number, please understand that in our world, we only need about 15% rent growth total over 5 years to achieve our goals, right? Most syndicators are looking to get about 15% of rent growth. Now, we also get rent growth from something called rehabbing. That's separate. That's a natural process. We get that. But from generic rent growth, we're looking for 15. And if you get 2 years, 1 at 6, 1 at 8, we've hit it, right? So that allows us not to create extraordinary returns of the sort that we've been creating the last 2 years. I'm sure you're aware that the crazy market had a lot to do with that. But 15%, 16% returns. In a world where the stock market is down 20% and it typically only produces about 6% over a 5-year annualized time frame, for us to produce 15 or 16, I'm very proud of it. Can I do more?
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Find somebody else. But I'm pretty proud of my 15 or 16.
No, I always say to people that, you know, don't look at the shiny numbers, you know, see, look at what, you know, risk managed way, what kind of returns that we're going to produce, right? And you talked about a few important points here that supply and demand, that imbalance that it has created, that the hole that it has created. Now, staying somewhere, having a place to stay is a need that we always talk about. It's not a want. It's not a choice, right? Everybody needs a place to stay. So I think that was a great kind of a bird's eye view of what this, you know, supply-demand dynamics are going to do, what in short term, what we should be cautious about. And in long run, it actually is creating a much healthier cycle when it comes to multifamily. So thank you so much for that perspective. Now, going a step beyond that, you know, in terms of real estate, if multifamily is kind of suffering a little bit, and, you know, I'm very cautious about multifamily too. I'm kind of waiting on the sideline for multifamily unless I see really good thing that we can go in into. But if not multifamily, what other diversification that the passive investors can look into? And I know you talk about a lot of asset classes. You are also, you know, syndicated in different asset classes. So what are you bullish on when it comes to real estate, other asset classes than multifamily?
Right now, I'm bullish on industrial as long as it's being purchased at a high cap rate. So the property mm-hmm. that I mentioned earlier on, I'm investing in small project, is with somebody who knows what they're doing. They've done this before. I've invested in industrial with them several times. They clearly understand the asset class really well. And basically, they're buying at an 8 cap. So I think the cap rate matters a great deal. 7 cap, right. 8 cap. If you're able to buy industrial at that cap rate, great. I like industrial. Nothing wrong with it. I think we're going to continue to have needs for industrial assets. So that's an opportunity. You know, I'm not offering any industrial projects. I'm simply a passive investor like you, just sharing my mm-hmm. thoughts. I do offer build-to-rent projects. So what has happened is, you know, until about 20 years ago, our homeownership rate in the U.S. was very high. I mean, much higher than Europe, much higher than most parts of the developed world. Almost close to 66-67% of Americans were somehow homeowners or lived inside a home that's owned by their families. Right. And that balance started to break as we started to run out of cheap real estate, right? So, you know, mm-hmm. we started to run out of cheap real estate, construction costs went up, that balance started to break. And then COVID happened. And post-COVID, construction costs went up by a shocking amount. We didn't build a lot of homes yeah. or didn't build enough. But most importantly, what happened is now that interest rates have gone up, the gap between a average monthly mortgage payment and the average rent is the mm-hmm. highest in history. And this has been recorded in April 2023. So in April 2023, it's a little less than highest in history. It was the highest in history a couple months ago, right? So that gap has increased a lot. Why? Because imagine the difference, what happens to your mortgage payment when you jump from an interest rate of 3% to an interest rate of 6.5%, right? So the mortgage payment jumped like crazy. Rents have gone up like crazy too, but they've gone up about 15%. The mortgage payment's gone up about 50%, right? So when right. you see these kinds right. of insane gap increases, what happens is that you're leaving behind well-paid people. So there's a lot of people in America that make, as a family, might make 120,000, or individuals that make 70 or 80,000, and they believed in the American dream of owning their own home. Well, that dream is right. gone. I don't mm. see the single family market has responded so well to these interest rate hikes that we've only seen a 5% price decline US wide. Obviously, that dream is not getting any closer, right? So even right. with 6.5% interest rates, even with 7% interest rates, if the single family market's only going to go down 5%, well, obviously there's going to be a big gap there. So now you have these mid-market Americans that normally are not renters mm-hmm. that have no choice but to rent simply because the mortgage payment is unaffordable. True. That segment, I believe, is somewhere around 10 million families. And wow. so, you know, somewhere around 10 million families that, you know, mm-hmm. would have normally owned their own properties. Those people right. don't want to live in apartments. They don't even want to live in class A fancy apartments. They actually want to live in a home. And so mm-hmm. my goal is to build townhomes. I started off, by the way, with single family and realized I was not meeting the requirements of those people. While they right. want a single family home with a backyard and 2-car garage, they can't afford that. So mm-hmm. I backed off and I re-engineered and said, I need to understand how much money these people make, right? And then
right.
I came to the conclusion that the single family dream, even as a renter, is lost. The dollars make no sense. But the right. townhome dream isn't lost. So in a townhome, you live in a 3-bed, 2.5-bath home, you have a small backyard, you have a small front yard, and you often have a 1-car garage. There's a few townhomes that I build that have 2-car garages, but mostly it's a 1-car garage, and then you've got, you know, the area in front of the house where you can park a second car, and plus you also have a parking spot somewhere else in the property. And right. to me, I think I realized that townhome was that solution. And so while I continue to build apartments and enjoy building them, and I continue to buy apartments, I think that the mid-market solution is inexpensive townhomes. My townhomes are not fancy. I am not trying to make them sexy with 10-foot ceilings and massive windows. No, I offer just 3 things that an apartment doesn't have. A backyard, a garage, and no neighbors above and below you. That's it. True. And I do not want to offer anything more than those 3. So I believe built to rent is the most disruptive asset class in America, as long as we don't overbuild them, as long as we're not trying to make them into fancy condos. And I'm trying to stay very, very hard away from that. I'm not building in fancy cities. I'm building in secondary markets with people who are like, yeah, I can commute 20, 30, 40 minutes. And I still want to live in that home. I still want to have a dog that can, you know, pee in the backyard.
Right.
And that's very close to my heart. So in the middle of, you know, building apartments and buying apartments, built to rent is something that I continue to do.
To me, it looks like a scaled down version of that American dream. So if you cannot have that you know, big single family house, you kind of still have that scaled down version and still live in it and enjoy with your family and your pets if you want to continue doing that. So thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And when it comes to, you know, your kind of the location that we always say, right, in real estate, it's really important. I typically have questions from investors. I stay in Austin, right? Do you have something in and around Austin that we can invest in? And I always try to tell them that, you know, it's not really the city around you that you should be investing in, but you should be looking at different parameters. And, you know, when it comes to the algorithms that you built and the data that you have, you know, the supporting the location logic that you have, I should say location magic that you have. Can you highlight a little bit on that, you know, what are the different factors, you know, in just a kind of a quick recap, what are the different factors when it comes to location that you look into that passive investors should also look into?
Sure. So the typical location factors, and by the way, Austin does really well on those factors, are things like population growth, job growth, income growth, home price growth, and crime reduction, right? So those 5, as you can imagine, Austin would do really well on all 5 of those, with one exception right now, it's home prices are falling. So, you know, Austin and Phoenix are the 2 in the United States that have seen the most home price declines, right? So they went up the most. So they were the 2 cities that increased the most. And then they've gone down 10% or 11% from peak, whenever, I think peak was June 2022. So I think both cities do really, really well on those. But beyond those, I look for cash flow. I'm looking at where can I give my investors cash flow? Where can I have reasonable cap rates? So I love Austin. I'm building a project at South Park Meadows. I'm building a project east of Austin. I also purchased a multifamily that's doing really well north of Austin in a city called Killeen because of the Austin effect. But I can tell you today, I'm not interested, by the way, in buying anything in Austin. I'm not interested in building anything in Austin. I think it's, I tell people, Austin is the greatest city in America that I don't want to invest in. Right? And they're like, why? It's such an amazing city, .com, all this capital coming in, all these people coming in. Short answer is math. I'm only interested in math. So it's clear that there are better options for investment that give us higher cash flow at lower risk than Austin today. Austin has become a Californian city in Texas. And I see that as being very problematic. I think it's a great place to live in. My son wants to live there. And I'm like, yep, this is an amazing place to live in. go there. So he did his internship this summer, or last summer in Austin. Loved it. He worked for Dell. So it's a great place to invest in. And I think that in the long run, if you had a 10-year time horizon, you'd probably want to invest in Austin more than any other place. Bottom line, though, is the math tells you that often the greatest cities in America are not the best places to invest in, simply because what you're doing is you're paying for their greatness. I would like to pay for things like rent. I would like to pay for things like property value, right? I would not want to pay for greatness. So to me, as great a city as Austin is, the mathematics, the numbers, don't show it to be a good place to invest in right now. Everything's a cycle. I'm sure I'm going to change that answer in 12 to 18 months.
Right. So if not, I mean, of course, we talked about Austin. So what are the cities that are on your kind of a radar for 2023?
The cities with distress. So the CBRE publishes a report that I consume almost like it's a dessert. It's like my tiramisu. It's a cap rate report. It just came out. So the data is all fresh in my mind. Right now, it makes sense to buy in Phoenix. Right now, it makes sense to buy in Atlanta. Why? Because Phoenix was a 3-cap market that today is a 5.75 cap market. In other words, you can get a 25 to 30% discount in Phoenix right now. Mm-hmm. And yes, Phoenix has lost some rents. They're down about 7%. But don't forget, Phoenix had the highest rent increases in 2021 of any city in America, large or small. It was crushing it.
Right.
Rents are up 25, 30%. So they've adjusted. And that's good. Remember, rents are also bubbles. If rents get too high, too fast, it creates problems. So we are seeing the Phoenix market adjust, not just because of interest rates, but also because its rents were too high and that adjustment's happened. And you're like, yeah, that sounds pretty bad. Bad for the seller. I'm a buyer, right? It's bad for them. They're selling a lot cheaper. So to me, when I look at a high quality market that's high growth like Phoenix that checks off all of the location magic numbers and I can get a 25% discount from 18 months ago, I'm pretty happy with that. And I'm pretty sure that Phoenix won't have any rent growth for this year. My investors will know that. You can't do the Warren Buffett thing if everything's going great. If everything's going great, where's the discount?
Right.
Atlanta's in a similar place, but not as bad, right? So you might get a 17 or 18% discount with Atlanta. It still has rent growth. So Atlanta's, rents are not declining. So you don't get as much of a discount as Phoenix, but, you're in a slightly better position. You'll get a bit more cash flow than you would in Phoenix. So I'd like to buy in both. And maybe the investors that are more sensitive to cash flow can go into my Atlanta properties and the ones that are less sensitive can go into the Phoenix properties. So I like those two. I don't like Miami at this point in time because it's still extremely expensive, low cap rates. California, I still think, has very low cap rates. So there's a few markets that are doing well. I think that some of the mid markets are also very interesting. Usually I don't invest in them. Oklahoma City, I think, is terrific. Mm-hmm. Tulsa is a place to look at. Indianapolis. Those three would be my count. They don't do phenomenally well from a location magic perspective, job growth, population growth, home price growth. But those cities are doing well because they are simply inexpensive compared to all of the other cities that we just talked about.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much for that perspective. I think Atlanta and Phoenix is the market that even I'm watching. So it's kind of good to know that you are looking at those markets too. So with that, I mean, this was a great conversation. It's kind of coming to an end to our next segment. And in my next segment, I'd like to ask my guest that, how do you, Neil Bawa, thinks outside the stocks?
I think what I do is I address my fears. Like everyone else, I have these fears. Oh my God, interest rates are going up. Oh my God, a recession is coming. And I write down those fears. I say, these are my fears. So in I use Apple Notes. I write them down and say, these are my top three fears. And then I go and spend an hour researching every fear. And then I write a paragraph. And that paragraph says, this is why I agree with this fear. Or this is why I disagree with this fear. By the time I'm done writing that fear, I feel liberated. I feel like my mind is now back to logic. My fear is either gone or it's being pushed back to where it should be so that logic can take over. It's a very useful exercise.
Right. Wow, there is like a method to the madness, right? I love that. And when it comes to your portfolio, if we are to look at, you know, what percentage that you see that, you know, it's in the stock market, is there in stock market, and what are the other asset classes? I could see that, you know, BTR and the multifamily syndication is a maybe a majority of portfolio. So where would we see Neil's portfolio in terms of like just the distribution of different asset classes? And what are those, you know, some fun asset classes that, you know, people don't even know or didn't even think about that you have invested in?
Right now, I'd invest in oil. I'd invest in shale because I think energy prices are going to skyrocket in the coming 5 years. I want to invest in food. So I want to do food syndications that involve farms. I want to do, you know, oil syndications. Multifamily is fairly evergreen and obviously is discounted at this point. So it's in my list. The one asset class that I have absolutely zero interest in is office. I think office is in a 10-year debacle. So I would not, right, you know, touch office with a 20-foot pole.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So the last round that we have is our rapid fire round, where we just ask some fun questions and quick, you know, 60-second answer to it. So are you ready for the rapid fire round?
Ready?
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us one fun fact about you in terms of your hobby, and what do you do when you're not being the mad scientist of multifamily?
I grow tomatoes, and I'm obsessed with getting the highest possible yield using data science. So I've tried everything from LED lights to trying different colors of sunlight, to trying different soil mixes, to trying different heights, to trying pruning. I like to document all of those to try and hack my way to the greatest tomato harvest of all time.
And that's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. What is that one advice that you have received that has completely changed your life?
It's The Miracle Morning. So the book that basically, you know, allows me to spend 60 minutes in the morning structuring my day has really been life-changing, even though it's not my favorite book, but I read my favorite book through The Miracle Morning.
I think both of us are big believers of that. I remember that. And what is that one quick advice that you will give to passive investors?
There is no such thing as a passive investor. It's a silly name. You're active. Your active job is to find the right syndicators. Ignore simply ignore the terms or the returns they're offering. It doesn't really mean anything. I don't know what the returns are going to be for any of my properties. We make assumptions. Invest based on their thought process. You're an active investor, and your job is to find the right people to invest with.
Thank you so much for sharing that eye-opening. Thank you so much again, Neil. And it was such a great conversation. I'm so grateful to have you here today. And thank you so much for your time again.
Thanks for having me, Madhvi. Have a good one.
You too. Thank you so much. So there we go. We had an excellent, excellent conversation with Neil Bawa, the mad scientist of syndication world. And I hope that you gathered a great nugget for yourself when it comes to investing and what you should be doing in the current recessionary environment that we are facing. We are all facing a lot of fear. There is a lot of concern around it. And I hope you got some pointers on how you can build your investment journey from here. And we think outside the stocks. Again, we do want to insist that this is all educational and information purpose only. We are encouraging you to get started with this educational journey, even if you are staying on the sideline. And think outside the stocks. If you head to the website, there's going to be a ton of material available for you. And I am available to you if you want to schedule a call and see if this is the right fit opportunity for you to see if these kind of investments work with your strategy. So feel free to schedule a call with me. I look forward to knowing more from you. Thank you so much for listening for another episode with Think Outside the Stocks. I will see you next week.
Thanks for tuning in to the Think Outside the Stocks podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like and subscribe. Madhvi is on a mission to change the financial trajectory of one family at a time with 1,000 more to go. We hope you'll be a part of this vision. Please join our growing community. And to get your journey started, visit thinkoutsidethestocks.com to download your free guide on active income with passive real estate investments. If you learn something new, please share it with one person today. And if you have 60 seconds, please leave us an Apple review to help us reach more people like you. Tune in for the next episode.